don't know who first said it, some ancient philosopher or poet, but there's supposed to be a great truth in the saying, moderation in all things. But the science writer Michael Easter says, truth is, as a species, we humans suck at moderating. We stare at our screens too much. We buy and consume too much. We crave sugar and possessions. Even though we live in a world of relative abundance, Easter says our brains have this ancient behavior system baked into our minds that tells us there's not enough. Like information. I mean, this is the information age for crying out loud, and still we crave more. And this is a lesson Michael Easter learned early in his career.
So this is 2010. I'm an intern at Esquire magazine. I think I'm pretty cool. And I get all sorts of assignments. Now, one of the assignments that I get as an intern there is to find out how much money the Pope makes. Okay. I'm on it. And I think I sent out a couple emails, do some Googling. I think I even talked to a Catholic academic. And okay, I send in my findings to my editor. 5 minutes later, I get an email back. Meet me in the conference room in 5 minutes. So I walk in there, and this guy's very Esquire. It's almost like he could have worked at the magazine in the 50s. Button unbuttoned, his tie is loose, it's the end of the day, he's just leaned back, you know, he could have been smoking a cigarette if that were allowed. And he goes, take a seat. So I sit down, and he just is silent for a while, for way too long. Guys, if you want to know how much money the Pope makes, you call the fucking Vatican. Call the fucking Vatican! And so to me, that was an aha moment in my journalistic career. That is the simple answer. If you want to know how much money someone makes, why don't you ask them? But we now live in a world where there is a million different ways to attempt to acquire information. Now, whether that information is good or bad, you don't know because you haven't gone to the actual source, right? We can go to all these different outside sources, chase down all kinds of answers that may or may not be right, and we oftentimes miss the obvious. Humans evolved to crave information because having information in the past would have given you a survival advantage. But today, we live in a world where any random question that pops into our brain, no matter what it is, you have this instant way to look that up. And you can get thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of answers. And this boils down to questions that actually impact your life. When people feel a pain in their side, what do? It used to be you would call the f***ing Vatican, meaning you would call a doctor. You'd be like, hey, doc, I need to get in. You'd go see the person. Now you might do that, but not before you've Googled it. So you hop on Google and the pain in your side, well, it could be you might have pulled a muscle in your workout. It could be cancer. Oh my God, it's definitely stage 4 cancer. And you can just keep going and going and going. And I don't think that's necessarily always a good thing.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Michael Easter is joining us to talk about his new book. It's called Scarcity Brain. And in it, he explains how this mindset works, how people can manipulate it, and how, even though it's not easy, you can detect these cues and resist them. The book is about happiness and exploration and what it means to live a fulfilling life. Here's Michael Easter.
I would say the first time I started thinking about it was right when the pandemic set off. Now, the moment for me when the pandemic it was on is when it was the Utah Jazz game, right? They got canceled.
Wow.
Where Rudy Gobert tested positive and it's like season's right. Over. Like, yeah. That was the moment. And it was like, you know, Utah was the they just canceled the Jazz game? Uh-oh. So what do you do?
Yeah.
Right? Everyone starts freaking out. And what do? We immediately – we need to hoard items. Things are going to be scarce. So you go to the grocery store and there's a ton of people there and everyone's just throwing stuff into their carts. Like you go with a, like my wife and I went with a list.
Yeah.
You find out after about the fourth item that there's nothing in this store that is on this list. You just got to get whatever you can. And I remember when it really set in for me, this was before, you know, people, we were told to wear a mask, where we were told to distance. Where, I mean, it was just happening. And there was a guy at the Smith's on Tropicana in Las Vegas who was wearing a full-on Tyvek suit and a sort of gas mask. And he had a cart that had cans, I mean, a full-size cart that had cans piled up like a pyramid. He had so many that they were falling as he was pushing it. And that's when I went, oh, my God, like, we need more, right? So this is like a massive scarcity cue in everyone's life.
So you had a scarcity cue there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You're trying to get anything you can. You're getting food that you're like, well, I would never eat this normally. Yeah, we're going to definitely need at least 15 tins of Spam. And I think everyone experienced that. And then what became interesting is that afterwards, once you have that initial shock, people started sort of leaning into more in other ways. So a significant amount of people gained weight.
Yeah.
You saw screen time spike, goes through the roof. You also see people start to spend a ton more money on stuff, right? People made all these impulse purchases.
Yeah.
So I think that was the first thing. And that's when my editor and I started talking about this idea is how does this feeling of scarcity impact people? And the second part of this was that this idea of a scarcity brain, it's that we never seem to be able to find enough.
Mm.
It's everyone knows that everything is fine in moderation, and yet everyone struggles with it. No one can find moderation. You know, we eat when we've had enough. We take that second cupcake. We buy more stuff on Amazon Prime when we just did the magic art of tidying up like a month ago. We spend a ton of time on social media, which is ultimately like trying to get more status. So I live in Las Vegas, right? And this is a good town to study moderation and why it's hard to find.
Yeah.
Because we fly in people just so they can have a week where they just go, I am not moderating. And then they leave on the flight Sunday morning with their tail between their legs and they've lost their money, they've lost their pride, they've gained 5 pounds in whatever it is, 72 hours. So it's an interesting town to study that. And the strange part about Las Vegas is the slot machines. That's the weirdest part to me.
Yep.
If anyone's been there, they are everywhere. And so I want to know why that is, because that to me is the most irrational behavior. Everyone knows the house always wins. Like, you know that in the back of your head. The house always wins. Yet people play and play. So I want to figure out why this is. And this ends up taking me to this casino on the edge of town in Vegas.
Quote unquote casino.
Quote unquote casino.
It's a casino laboratory.
It's a casino laboratory. This is the crazy thing. It's a fully working casino, except it's used entirely for human behavior research, basically. Now, when I'm there, I end up talking to a guy who designs slot machines. And he starts explaining to me why slot machines work. And they work on a three-part system that I call the scarcity loop.
Yeah.
And so this makes all of a sudden slot machines become very exciting because you know you're going to win at some point, but you don't know how much it's going to be. You know it's going to come very soon though, right? So you play on nearly half of games. You're going to win something. But is it going to be less than your bet, or is it going to be like a lot more than your bet? And that unpredictability, that grabs the attention. Unpredictability generally grabs the attention of humans, pigeons, rats, cats. I mean, we can just go on down the line of any animal we've studied.
What are they keying in terms of human behavior and human evolution that helps them get us to keep pushing that button?
So this scarcity loop, once I learn about it from this guy at the casino lab and that this is what makes slot machines work, I go, okay, it's starting to make a little bit of sense, but like, why does it work in the first place? Why would that grab our attention? So I end up calling this guy whose name is Thomas Zental, and he's a psychologist at University of Kentucky. And he told me this, because he's done all sorts of research on gambling and behavior. And he thinks that our attraction to this loop likely tracks back to evolution and finding food. So if you think about our ancestors, you had very few jobs. It was to have some children, find food, and don't die.
Yeah.
Now, finding food, you don't know where the food is, right? You have an opportunity to find food and therefore survive, because if you don't, you're going to starve. But it's unpredictable. You don't know where the food is. If it's an animal, you don't know where it's going to be. You don't know how big it is. You don't know if it's with an entire herd of animals. You don't know all these things. It's an unpredictable game. And then, by the way, you got to repeat that behavior every single day to get food in order to survive. So you'd be going to one place, no food, the next place, no food, the next place, no food, the next place, ding, 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 jackpot. Oh my God, we just found a massive grove of berries, and this is going to keep us alive for the next week or whatever it might be. So it's very much an unpredictable rewards game, just like slot machines are. And that explains today why we become so entranced in this loop. So why would someone play a slot machine? It's because we're not living the way that we used to. And things have changed so much, and I don't know if our brains have necessarily caught up. And we look for stimulation in some strange places sometimes.
Michael Easter, his latest book is called Scarcity Brain: Fix Your Craving Mindset and Rewire Your Habits to Thrive with Enough. I'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Let's talk a little bit about how the scarcity loop works in another behavior that some people may find familiar. You went through this. I think a lot of us have, just buying crap endlessly. For some reason, buying a Subaru when you try to justify this to your wife, you write about. But not only that, and this happened during the pandemic. It happens all the time anyway. People just get addicted to buying stuff that they don't need. Mm-hmm. What's going on there? Help us understand the idea of conspicuous consumption you write about, which I found interesting, was coined in like 1899 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not a new thing. But what's happening here? How does the scarcity loop play into the way we buy this stuff?
So in the book, I argue that a lot of behaviors that might seem strange today that we do in excess, they fall into the scarcity loop.
Right.
And shopping is definitely one of them. So I'll give you an experience of how I experience shopping. It's like I have an opportunity to get an item that I think is going to enhance my life somehow. Could be a piece of clothing that makes me look real cool. Could be some item that I think is going to solve this perceived problem I have. Could be some item that maybe is going to make me feel like I belong, like I'm part of a bigger thing, right? I'm going to buy a jersey of my favorite team. So I have this opportunity, and then I got to search for it, right? And so when I decide I'm going to want this thing, I go out into this vast world of the internet, and you make that purchase. It feels great, and you wait for it, and it arrives, and you're like, oh, cool. Now what?
Yeah.
Quick repeatability.
So what does the scarcity loop tell us about? You write about brand tribalism in the book. You write about just the way we think about necessity and possessions. What did you learn about the way we think about those things in researching the book?
Well, I think there are basically four reasons why people buy. The first is because we actually need the item to accomplish something.
Yeah.
The other reason is for status. You could get the Prius, but you're going to get the Mercedes because that makes you look really cool. We also buy things to belong.
Yeah.
So maybe you get the Jeep Wrangler because there's a huge community of people who buy Jeep Wranglers, right? And you want to hang out with those people. And you're going to put the sticker on the back that says Utah Jazz or whatever it is,
right,
to belong.
Right.
Or Black Rifle Coffee Company.
Absolutely.
And then the fourth reason, I think, is just out of boredom. We live in a time now where, you know, one of the main sort of ideas in the book is that we evolved in environments where everything we needed to survive was scarce. And so we sort of crave all these things that we needed, but they're now abundant and more easily accessible than ever. So even just 15 years ago, if I'm sitting around and bored and I go, oh, it'd be cool to have that Black Rifle Coffee Company sticker to put on my Jeep, I would have to go down to the Black Rifle Coffee Company store. There's a pause there.
Yeah.
Now I can just immediately when this idea pops into my head because I'm kind of bored, I can just immediately go on the internet and buy it, and it'll be there in a short amount of time.
An important part of the book, Michael, is your various adventures, some of them crazy and super dangerous, like going to Baghdad. But others are – and we'll get to this one in a minute, your experience in a monastery. You also did a kind of Uber hike experience with a woman named Laura Zara. You describe her as a one-off creature. tell us about Laura and tell us about your experience with her.
She's probably definitely top three coolest people I've ever met. Huh. So she, you know, she was doing the normal thing that a smart 20-something year old would do, and that she was going to a really great school on the East Coast. She was getting straight A's. But at the same time, her life was a little bit strange in that while she was at this school, it was Connecticut College, she lived out in the woods and she would even like hunt animals out there. So she didn't really even spend time in her dorm room. It's all living out in the woods. And she's always just been naturally drawn to spending extended time in nature, like in wild places. And her idea, though, while she was at college was, okay, I'm going to get the best grades I can so I can get the best job that I can so I can have this time off where I can go out and do these wild adventures I want to go on. And at a certain point, she realizes, wait a minute, you don't really need to pay that much money to just go be in nature. So maybe I don't need that job because then I don't even have to worry about getting my 4 weeks of vacation or whatever it might be. So she quit school senior year, final semester, which of course, you know, made her parents really happy.
Right.
And she starts traveling. And she basically starts traveling with a backpack filled with necessities only. I mean, this is all she has. And she doesn't have much money. And she hitchhikes. She'll hitch a ride out to Montana and just go out into the wild for a bunch of time. And then come back out into civilization when she needs certain things. And then she's going to go back out. And she's lived that way pretty much the entirety of her life. And so I go spend some time with her in Montana. And what was really fascinating to me is, you know, I'm getting ready to go do some backpacking. And so I show up and I got a backpack the size of a refrigerator.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, I got all these different layers and all this food and, you know, a big tent and all these things I'm going to need to be outside. And, you know, she has just bare necessities of, yeah, like, don't die out there. And I had her call my items, be like, what would you bring? And so I went with it. And we went out there, and it was so fascinating to me because she's developed this hobby of shed hunting,
yeah,
which, if you're not familiar, ungulate animals, so elk, deer, et cetera, they lose their antlers every year. And so she literally searches the wild. She goes out for months at a time and will just walk around nature trying to find sets of antlers. And by the way, the important part is that she doesn't sell them because some people will sell them
for a lot of money.
Yeah. Especially if it's a bighorn sheep skull that's well preserved. I mean, that can go for more than $1,000. She does it entirely for the search of it. And that is the scarcity loop. She's got an opportunity to find this thing that she values. She doesn't know where it is. She doesn't know how big those antlers are going to be. She doesn't know.
Yeah.
But she's searching and searching, and she just gets obsessed with that. Now, the difference between that and the playing the slot machine, exact same architecture of the behavior,
right,
is that as she's doing that, she is out in nature.
Yeah.
She is being very physically active, and she's doing this thing that is really enhancing, I think, her life and her perspective.
Well, the thing that was interesting, too, is the way you work through the importance of exploration. And in fact, you talk about this study that played out. It was at the University of Illinois and Johns Hopkins about those who – I think it was kids. They did this study and they found that those who had scarce resources performed better. And it seems like this is something you're really interested in, having to go out and disconnect yourself from technology or whatever it is makes you more inclined to be creative and think of solutions and think differently about things. Just talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, I started thinking about this because of Laura, because she told me, you know, part of what has made her adventure so fun and rewarding is that when she doesn't have an item, she doesn't have the money to just go buy it. So she would have to find it. She'd have to engineer it. She would have to maybe use something that she already owned in a way that was creative and unpredictable to solve a problem. And she told me, she's like, this is so much more rewarding than just going and buying something to solve this problem. So I start looking into that. And there's actually research on this, as you alluded to. There was a study where they told a group of people that resources were scarce, and they had these certain sets of items, and they had to solve this different range of problems. And the people who were faced with scarce resources and had to solve the problem, they solved it more creatively. But I think what's more important is that they got more internal rewards out of that. It's like, oh man, I really fixed this thing. And they also didn't use as many resources, right? So now I think today we have the easy button where, well, the chips are stale, so Amazon special chip clip. Oh, I can get 79 chip clips for $7.99. Let's have them come. You've probably got a million things in your house that can seal that bag. A rubber band, a hair tie, like all these different things. And, you know, it's kind of MacGyver-ish.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're using less resources. You're being creative. You're having to exercise in, I think, a more perhaps interesting part of your brain.
Let's talk about how food gets into the story. Because you say in the book that our relationship with food started to really change at a certain point. Our relationship with food starts to change in the 70s, around there. What's happening?
So before the 70s, people generally ate three square meals. In the 1970s, the food industry goes, well, you can only sell people so much food if they're eating three square. So they start to really push this, what was a new idea then, of snacking.
Right.
So a snack is when you eat between meals because you're hungry. Trust us, you're hungry.
Right.
Now, if a person has recently eaten, the food can't be that filling, but it's still got to be delicious enough that you're going to want to eat it. So what ends up happening is they produce a wide range of different ultra-processed foods that come in a lot of different flavors. And importantly, they're not very filling, and you can eat them very quickly. So when a food is ultra-processed, think of how fast you can eat it.
Yeah.
Picture eating an ounce of potato chips versus an ounce of boiled potato. Right? You could put down many, many ounces of potato chips, but how many boiled potatoes are you going to eat? The answer is not many.
Well, this gets us to another adventure that you went on, to the Bolivian Amazon. And this extraordinary people, this tribe, the Chimane people, who you say in the book sort of have managed to sidestep this scarcity loop. And for I guess, important reasons that you write about, they don't die of heart attacks. And in fact, scans reveal, you say this in the book, that they had the healthiest hearts ever recorded by science. So to talk about the Chimane people.
Yeah, well, what got me so interested in this group, first of all, is that I've always been interested in heart disease. I actually have a poster on my office wall that shows heart disease by far kills the most amount of people every year. It is the biggest killer of Americans, full stop. So I have that, and then I come across a study that found that this group has the healthiest hearts ever recorded by science. And so I go, okay, well, let's go see what's going on there.
Literally, I'll go there.
Yeah, I'll go there. So I fly into La Paz, and it was kind of funny because I was supposed to then fly down to the jump-off point in the Amazon, and the flights end up getting canceled the day before I arrive, so I got to take this crazy car ride down that takes 12 hours instead of a 30-minute flight. And then we get in a canoe and take it 6 hours upriver, up a feeder river of the Amazon. And eventually you just pull off in the jungle and you're trusting the guide. You're like, okay, well, I guess he knows what's going on. And I go meet with these people. And like, there they are. And, you know, the first thing that happens is they welcome me with a meal. And that's where you can start to unpack why they don't get heart disease. So every single thing that they eat, the theme is that it has just one ingredient. So it's white rice. It is sweet potatoes. It is red meat that they've hunted. It is fish. It is fruit. It is some nuts. And I'm not going to lie, the meals were not delicious.
Yeah, you said the flavor wasn't quite there in some way.
The flavor was not there.
Yeah.
But I think due to the fact that these foods have one ingredient, they're naturally going to be more filling. You don't have all these levers that the junk food industry pulls to get you to eat more faster. So you end up eating a lot less. And as one of the funny, strange parts of this book, and this was my editor's idea, he said, now that you're back from the Amazon, why don't you try this stuff in the U.S.? And so,
I guess you should say that there's one of the tribe members, Liancino.
Yeah.
You asked him at this part of the book, you were like, what do you eat every day? Take me through that. And you, for a while, you're like, I'm going to eat like Liancino, right? Mm-hmm. Like the chamane.
Yep. So every day they're eating, breakfast could be rice with some eggs or something. So they've got chickens all over. Lunch might be some baked plantains with some fish that they've just pulled out of the river. So a lot of catfish. And then dinner might be some red meat they've hunted, like a tapir, I think they're pronounced, T-A-P-I-R, which is a form of – they're called an Amazonian deer, along with more white rice or maybe some sweet potatoes. And throughout the day, they might be snacking on some fruits and things like that. So I decide, okay, I'm going to try and replicate this to the best of my ability at home. And first thing I do is go to Costco, and I very quickly realize that the vast majority of that store, everything has more than one ingredient. Like everything. There's entire aisles. I mean, aisle after aisle, you're like, well, okay, this is going to be a very boring month. But I follow it to the best of my ability. And I will tell you, it is it's filling per calorie. I ended up starting to lose weight rather fast. And I also slept better. Just a lot of good things started happening. And the takeaway for me was not, okay, for the rest of my life, I am always going to eat like this.
No.
But the takeaway for me is, what elements of this can I insert into my normal diet? So I've started to insert a lot more foods that have just one ingredient and sort of lean on those. And I think that this often goes counter to diet culture as we know it, where, something is always getting vilified.
Yeah. You have to be all in.
You have to be all in. The reality is that, humans have been eating foods that have just one ingredient basically since we became humans. And that's probably still a good path to the basket for all of us. At the same time, I don't want to live in a world where I can't have a handful of whatever, salsa verde Doritos or whatever one it is, right? But I think we do have to balance that. And it's amazing to live in today's world. So the answer is not don't lean into any of these things that we've been talking about. But it's how do you find moderation?
Moderation, right. and balance. Mm-hmm. Which we'll come back around to here in a second. But one of the perks of doing this research was you actually got to talk to an astronaut in outer space. Explain what you figured an astronaut would teach you about the scarcity crisis or loop.
Well, I didn't anticipate learning anything at first, to be honest. But I got this email from NASA that an astronaut wanted to FaceTime with me, basically. And I was absolutely skeptical at first. I'm going, I don't know. I feel like I'm going to have to hand over my credit card, and there's going to be all these strange charges. And
well, he had read the Comfort Crisis, the book you had written before. This is Mark Vandehei.
Yeah. So he had
and he wanted to talk to you.
Yeah, he wanted to talk to me. So NASA has a program where if an astronaut wants to talk to someone who is not their family, who they're actually able to talk to every single day, FaceTime with, which is nice. They'll reach out to him. So he's read my book. He goes, yeah, reach out to this guy. I'll talk to this guy if he'll talk to me. So I said, yeah, of course I'll talk to you.
Yeah.
So he comes through the screen, and he's floating in outer space.
Yeah.
He's in the ISS. So you're just going, whoa, this is wild. He gives me this tour of the ISS. But I think the real message and where the conversation became interesting is that, I asked, what are you doing up there?
Yeah.
What's the point of going up there? He goes, well, the whole point is to find information. And the information that we are looking for is information that we can hopefully use Should we, as a species, ever need to exit this planet in the unfortunate event that things go totally awry? Now, for that person to get that information, it took a lot of effort. It is a mind-body effort, right? He had to go into the beyond and explore. And this sort of got me thinking and going down a rabbit hole of information and how we get it,
yeah,
and how that's changed. So when you look at humans and how we've expanded, we are the ultimate explorer species.
Which is unique among most animals. We go out and venture in a way that most don't. They stay in a space.
They stay in a space, right. And even if they do sort of move out, it's very slow and they change over time. They change into different species of animals.
Right.
We took over the world very quickly. And we've gone to places no other animals have gone. So we go into the depths of the ocean, right? We shoot ourselves into outer space. We go climb Everest. We go into the poles. We're just amazing explorers. And ultimately, those explorations are a search for information, information that can improve our life and hopefully help us live better. It's a search for greener grass. We're just never satisfied. Once we find the greener grass, we go, is there a better shade though? And maybe I'll go there now.
Yeah.
But I do think, and part of what this book gets into, is that we still have this craving for information. We still want to explore for information. But the way we do that has shifted.
Yeah.
We no longer have to put in this mind-body effort. We now have this sort of easy way to get it through Google, through the internet, through Twitter, through insert all different ways we get information now. And I think that can become overwhelming, one. Mm-hmm. And I think that also changes human experience. So when is the last time you went into a situation totally cold that you could have looked up before? I mean, think of something mundane.
Right.
Like go to a restaurant.
Right.
Like, Doug, we're going to a new restaurant.
Yeah. You're going to look up the menu, what people are saying about it.
Got to read the reviews.
You got to read the reviews, all of that.
Got to look at the menu. Got to do X, Y, Z. Got to get as much information about this place as I can.
What's the parking like?
What's the parking? Yeah. How long is it going to take to get there?
No exploration involved in that whatsoever. You're primed and prepped.
Yes. You're going in knowing as much as you possibly can. And that changes your expectations of the experience. You already know what you're going to order because, you know, Jimmy 99, yeah. Utah Utes are awesome. Has told you, you know what, the cod, overrated,
yeah.
But the salmon,
right.
Awesome, except tell them to hold the onions,
yeah.
Because there was too many onions. And you're going, oh, okay, well, Jimmy 99, Utah Utes are awesome, says that. And I think that that changes something about being a human, because we are a species that goes into the unknown and goes, what is over there? And that is a scarcity loop. You have this opportunity to get to greener grass. The grass could be brown. Oh, bummer. The grass could be the same shade that you came from. You go, well, I put in some effort. I'm in a new place. It's decent. Or it could be the most vibrant shade of green you've ever seen. You go, oh, my God. Amazing. I'm so glad I came here. That's great. And then you repeat the search.
Yeah.
So I can tell you, and this is kind of a silly, mundane example, but I think it's important, is that the places that my wife and I, for example, the restaurants in Las Vegas that we love the most, none of them came through Yelp.
You just found them.
We just found them.
You went out and, like, let's explore.
Let's explore. Another one, we're just driving through Las Vegas and you go, oh, I'm hungry. This place looks kind of interesting. Let's just pull in. Let's, like, not even just knowing nothing. And it was the best place ever. And you look up its Yelp rating and it doesn't get the best score because someone was like, well, the music was a little too loud. And I didn't like the decor. I didn't like all these different things about it. And that ultimately changes things.
Yeah. Right?
I don't always think for the best. But it's obviously not just restaurants. It's books. It's movies. It's
a city. You write about that. Like going into small towns and exploring. Going into even big cities and going to places you hadn't before. And this is another really interesting part of the book, this idea of going out and just going for a walk and exploring in a way that doesn't involve a piece of technology that preps you or primes you for the experience, but just discovering it yourself, I guess.
Yeah, it's totally new. And you're taking in new information in the present like we have for hundreds of thousands of years. And that improved our life. I mean, there's even research that says entering new environments and walking through them without having your attention focused on a phone, by the way, seems to enhance creativity, seems to reduce stress. It seems to do all these good things for people. So, you know, and one thing is I don't want people to think that the message of this book is like, don't use any of these amazing things that we have now, because they are. But I do think that we should be conscious about how they shape our experience and how we spend our life and how we spend our time and how we spend our attention. Because there's this William James quote in the book that ultimately at the end of your life, and I'm paraphrasing him, your life is a culmination of what you paid attention to.
Yeah.
And we pay so much attention now, anywhere from 12 to 13 hours, to all this digital media we're surrounded in. And I guess I don't want people to look back on that and go, I wish I wouldn't have spent so much time on Instagram or whatever it is, TikTok or doom scrolling the news or whatever it might be.
Michael Easter, his book is Scarcity Brain. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This really, I thought, beautiful moment in the book you have where you're talking to the astronaut Mark Vandehei, and he shows you basically the Earth's atmosphere, that varnish of blue, as I guess he described it to you. And then he just sort of let you sit with it. He was kind of quiet, I guess, silent for a while, and just let you take it all in. And one of the insights he mentioned to you, which I really loved, is he said that, you know, we don't live in the Earth. We live in the atmosphere. And Michael Easter, here it is. Look at this. And he let you just sort of sit with it. And you say it gave you a different perspective.
Oh, I'll be honest. It was pretty emotional.
Huh.
Because you just go, it's not that big coming through the screen. And from his vantage point, it's not that big.
Right.
And you realize, oh, there we all are. All of our lives and problems and hopes and joys and stories and wars and history and whatever, it's all just happened right there. And by the way, when you're viewing it from space, you realize you have maybe a better concept of time and how old things are. And you go, oh, and it's also just like a millisecond in the grand scheme of time and space. And it's like, whoa. And that's pretty heavy. But also I think it changes your perspective in a way too, that it helps put things in perspective.
Let me ask you about one last experience that you write about in the book, your experience at Our Lady of Guadalupe Monastery. This is in New Mexico's Gila National Forest. First of all, explain why you went, because you say in the book you couldn't really explain why you visited this monastery with any coherence or conviction. You just thought you wanted to go.
Yeah, I think part of it was that we live in a world where, you know, everyone wants to be happy. A lot of philosophers would argue that everything that we do is just a search for happiness. Ultimately, that's what we want. And we now live in a world where there's so much information about how to be happy. There's all these things you got to do to be happy. And these monks, they live in a way that doesn't exactly jive with that research. So they have a pretty tough life. They get up very early to go to their morning chants, which are at 3 a.m. And they do 7 sessions a day. They're told to, you know, take meager rations. Don't eat too much. So they don't eat a ton. They also do a lot of hard physical labor. By the way, they're in silence for most of the time. There's a lot of hardship about the life, but there's also research that suggests that they're happier than the average American, like significantly. And so what's up with that? Because that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So I go spend a week with them, and it was definitely a fascinating and transformative experience for me.
You write about how their philosophy can be summed up, pray and work. And you write about, for example, there was this repetition in your experience that you write about. I wrote it down here. You wake up early, go to the chapel, eat a meal, break, go to the chapel, eat a meal, break, do work, break, go to the chapel, eat a meal, go to the chapel, sleep. Repetition. And you do that every day.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was a week. For these guys, it's the rest of their lives.
For the rest of their lives.
And I think another important thing is that I was expecting to go in to hang out with a group of people who would, you know, qualify for AARP. I assumed it would be all these older people. The average age is 30.
Wow.
There's people there who are 19, 20 years old and go, I think I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. That schedule that you just fired off. That is every single day for the rest of their life. That's pretty heavy. But people like that are very interesting to talk to because I don't talk to people like that often, and they often have some pretty fascinating insights.
Well, it's this interesting part of the book, too, where you write about your own experience when you were going to the monastery, having to sort of learn about Catholicism and the Bible in a way you hadn't really – you weren't religious, although you spent a lot of your time growing up in Bountiful, Utah, which is, as you say, 90-plus percent Mormon. You're not Mormon, and you write a little bit about sort of being dismissive about religious people for a time because you saw stuff that wasn't – you didn't like or approve of. But then there's this, I don't know, this kind of revelation that you go through that you write about in the book where you're not – you don't become religious, but you kind of become spiritual. At least you embrace what you describe as this balance between, as you say, science and soul. We'll talk about that.
Well, my job – I mean, as a science journalist, I read a lot of studies. I talk to a lot of people who conduct research. And it's all great, and I think it can all give us information that is useful. But I've also found that through all the traveling I've done, all the different people I've talked to, that what transforms humans the most, it's not anything you can study, right? It's not going to be prettily written up in a research paper. Science can't necessarily describe it. And so what's up with that? And I think we live in a time where sometimes that gets dismissed, although that is often what is most important about being a human. And I think that for most of time, religion has tried to provide those answers to people. Has it done it perfectly? Most people would say no, yes, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The point, I think, is that when you sort of boil down most religions, they're basically just trying to get you out of yourself. And realizing that there are sort of higher things that we don't understand and trying to kind of get you to do the next sort of right thing, really. And so that was ultimately my takeaway, that the answer is remembering that you're not the center of the universe. And I think that that's maybe easier than ever to do today. I mean, you can have your own media site that's all about you at Instagram.com. And well, it's nice to use to be able to keep in touch with people. I don't know if we're moving in a way that is getting to these sort of larger questions about being a human and the sort of deeper things that give us long, meaningful satisfaction to make us look back on our life and say, all right, I think I did that well.
You say it's spirituality counters what the scarcity brain pushes us into. And asks us, this is how you put it in the book, to do the deep work. What do you think the deep work is?
Well, I think that all of it is tough. Like, the reason that we fall into behaviors that are in the scarcity loop, whether it's spending more time on our phone, whether it's gambling, whether it's eating that second helping of food, is because it does provide a sort of short-term relief from our problems. It gives us a nice fleeting hit of joy, but it ultimately is fleeting. And when you do that in excess, you tend to find that most people will experience longer term problems in their life. And so a lot of, I think, what religions do is trying to get us out of that cycle. And the deep work really is, I think the story of improving your life today is that you often have to sort of embrace these sort of short term discomforts and hardships. So you can get that sort of long-term benefit. And that goes from losing weight to improving your mental health to asking deep questions about, like, why am I here? And how do I want to spend my life? You know, take even a figure like Jesus or Buddha. They go through this hardship, and what do? They go out alone and they wander the world asking hard questions, going like they struggle. It's not easy. But on the other side of that, they learn something important about themselves. And I think that that is they're just normal people who did something extraordinary and learned something from it. And I think that that's a good lesson for everyone. You know, I think that everyone is capable of anything. You just have to be willing to kind of put a little bit of work in.
I think it's important to say that the book includes these kind of suggestions that you offer for kind of reverse engineering some of these things. And you included in the book, you know, slow down the quick repetition by like not keeping the foods that trigger you in the house. I mean, you have some really practical stuff here. We can resist our informivore brain. It's a word that you describe in another part of the book that people will encounter when they do that. But that the unpredictable rewards of information we read online are sometimes misdirection. So just as you say, being aware of how people are trying to play with all of that. Anyway, there are a lot of these sort of kind of practical things that you really do get at in the book as well. But I wanted to end with something you mentioned Joseph Campbell, something that he said, that the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. I mean, that astronaut you talked to, he was sacrificing his bone density. I mean, you know, this was there are risks that people take. That's the cool part about us in some ways. And that seemed like also part of the hard work is that just getting to that part. You want to say something about that Campbell quote? Because I think that seemed to sum it up nicely.
Yeah, I think that we live in a world now that is amazing in that it is safe, comfortable. There's all these things that we sort of need to survive, right? But I don't necessarily know if or think that having everything very easy is rewarding for us on a deep, deep level. So the Campbell quote is that, you know, what you often need is to go do these things that you are most afraid of. That is where the real, that is where the real reward lies. That is the story of the hero or heroine, right? Every single culture has the same basic narrative where the hero or heroine gets called to adventure, and at first they don't want to do it.
Yep.
Like, don't want to do this, don't want to deal with it. But they enter this sort of really trying middle ground, and they struggle there, and it is hard. But in that process, they learn something about themselves, and they return back to normal life, and they're enhanced as a person. They're an entirely new person because they've developed all these skills, they've learned all this important information that's going to change the behavior. But they had to do that hard thing. It didn't come for free. There were moments where they wanted to quit, but they just kept going and came out a better person.
Michael Easter, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Michael Easter. His new book is Scarcity Brain: Fix Your Craving Mindset and Rewire Your Habits to Thrive with Enough. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. If you have ideas or comments, email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Elle Cowley, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.